Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh. How so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit. Or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at ikea-usa.com today.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Caleb Zacharin, the assistant editor of the New Books Network, and you're listening to New Books in Popular Culture. Today, I'm speaking with Jody Rosen about his new book, Two Wheels Good, The History and Mystery of the Bicycle, from Crown Publishing. Jody writes for the New York Times Magazine, where he has written about everything from Mr. Softee's ice cream to scam rap. Two Wheels Good is a sweeping exploration of the bicycle, from its invention in 1817 to the present day. This book was truly a joy to read, and readers will no doubt find that the bicycle's place in modern history should not be underestimated. Jody, thank you for joining me today on the New Books Network.
Thanks, Caleb. Really happy to be here.
So first question, sort of standard with New Books Network, is if you could just tell me a little bit about your background and why it is that you chose to write a book about the history of the bicycle.
Yeah, so let's see. I'll try and do the, should I do the short version of my background and how I got
go for it.
The long version?
Go for the long version. It's New Books Network, so.
Okay. I started out way back when thinking I was going to be an academic. So I was doing graduate work at one point with an eye to being like an American cultural historian. And for various reasons, chiefly my not wanting to take a good job that wasn't in New York City, like in, you know, Lincoln, Nebraska or someplace like that, essentially to anywhere other than New York, I realized that among other things was that the academic career path was not for me. So I've always been kind of a frustrated, like lay historian, hack historian. and sort of envy my friends who wound up in the academy in various ways. But I also was very fortunate to kind of fall into a career in journalism. And when I say fall in, that's more or less what I did, because I wound up writing a couple things for the online magazine Salon back in the late 90s. And then I got a call from an editor at the New York Times, and suddenly I was doing pieces for the Arts and Leisure section there about music. The reason I was doing them about music is A, I always loved music, but the pieces I'd done for Salon had been about music. So I kind of became not because it was, you know, my explicit career plan, but I became a music critic kind of by default, because I was anointed as one, and wound up doing that for some years. For various publications, including the online magazine Slate. I was the music critic for The Nation. I was a music critic for New York Magazine for a while, wrote a lot for The Times and other outlets, Rolling Stone. And I always felt like, I mean, I love writing about popular music. I still do it to an extent, but I always felt like a frustrated generalist. Like I was kind of pigeonholed in as a music critic and didn't want to be one. So I had to kind of, through various career intrigues and machinations, make my way over to being accepted as a generalist. one thing that characterized, I'd say, the music criticism I did was a kind of a long view. I was always very interested in history. So even if I'd be writing about, you know, hip hop, which I did a lot of, I'd also be like trying to bring in, you know, circa 1911 Irving Berlin, that kind of thing. So anyway, I wound up eventually getting a job at the Times Style magazine, the magazine T, as their as what was called a critic at large, where I then suddenly wasn't just writing about music, but I was writing pieces about a little bit of everything: politics, culture, transportation. And transportation was always a big interest of mine. So to circumnavigate now, like as if on a meandering bike ride to the bicycle, yeah, I've always ridden a bike every day, all the time, my entire adult life. And a substantial period of my childhood, it was my primary means of transportation, and have always been fascinated by the bike as a cultural object, as an art object, and have been fascinated by its history. And there's an extensive literature on the bicycle, which I've kind of vacuumed up over the years. But I found myself frustrated with a lot of at least the kind of popular literature, the trade literature on the bike, because it was in various ways, I thought, a little parochial in its interests. You know, it was mostly focused on America and Western Europe, even though the bicycle was a very much a global phenomenon. And there are many, many more bikes, for instance, in the global South than they are in around these parts. And also, you know, that literature is often quite romantic and sentimental about the bike. So I should say there's a very robust academic literature on the bicycle, which I am indebted to. And I sort of, you know, when I turned more seriously to this project, started reading a lot of that too. But that is, as I promised, a long answer because about how I got to this subject. It was something I always wanted to do, had contemplated for many years. And at some point I said, okay, I'm gonna do this. I'm gonna sit down and write a book proposal and try and get a deal to write about the bicycle. And that's what happened. And I got that deal, I'll say, a lot longer ago than I should have. That is to say, it took me forever and a day to write this book, but I'm pleased that I finally got it done and out in the world.
What percentage of the book would you say was written while riding on a bike? Where it was this, your kind of, you know, you're thinking about this book, your companion piece while you were riding around?
Good question. I don't know how to break it down in percentage terms. I don't know about writing, but certainly the thinking, the musing on the bike, you know, my deep thoughts, as it were, about the bicycle as a kind of the sensual experience of riding the bike, and things I write about the kind of engineering of the bike. Those thoughts very much consume me when I'm out on the bike. Also, I think a lot about the way one interacts with the environment, with the cityscape, with New York in particular, when I'm out on the bike. And so, yeah, I've done a lot of kind of contemplating of these various topics while out on the bike. And when writing this book, you know, whenever I was stuck, I think I mentioned this in the book, but when I was like stuck or like, you know, experienced some form of writer's block or just was like, couldn't hack it, couldn't type another word, I'd head out on the bike, kind of ride going nowhere in particular. And that generally was a good way to shake things loose and to get the juices flowing again.
So, you know, you begin the book by telling this sort of story where you go to this this church in England, and there's this window pane, which is, you know, legend has it that it's of a bicyclist. It's not, but why did you choose to start the book with this story? And how does this sort of frame this idea of the bike, even though it does have this sort of very, you know, more or less established origin in 1817, this kind of idea that the bike is something that, you know, has existed for all time, for since the beginning of human history, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess the crucial fact there, and one of like the these central facts and conundrums of the bicycle is that it arrived so late. You know, it's the technology to create a bike has been available since the Middle Ages, but for various reasons, you know, humankind never got around to like creating the bike proper until this relatively recent date in history. You know, it's the second decade of the 19th century. And I think that's part of the reason that there's so many apocryphal stories, kind of, you know, bogus origin stories, creation myths that have circulated around the bike since its invention. And you know, also it's such a simple machine. It's such sort of like how should I put this? It's simple. There's very few working parts in the bicycle. You look at it, it's kind of transparent. You can read how it works almost without ever, if you were a person who just, you know, teleported down to Earth and never seen a bicycle, I think you'd pretty quickly be able to figure out how the machine worked and how to ride one, at least in theory. So for that reason, again, it seems like something that's elemental and that should have been there, you know, for all time, or should have been, you know, its origins should have been in antiquity and not in, you know, the, not something you could trace to the Duchy of Baden in 1817. I noticed in the literature that there were a lot of these bogus stories. And in fact, a lot of that stuff has wound up in books that are, you know, published by respectable presses. My own day job, the New York Times, you know, when I was researching this book, in 1974, there was the purported discovery of a bicycle, a drawing of a very modern looking bicycle in the notebooks of Leonardo da Vinci. This story was reported all over the world and quickly exposed as a hoax. But in the New York Times, they're reporting on this discovery. They say, there's also, you can, if you look at bas reliefs, you can find images of bicycles that we can trace back to ancient Babylonia and Egypt and, you know, ancient Rome. So all of these myths have worked their way into very respectable literature and journalism, and that kind of persistence of these tall tales fascinated me. So yeah, I went in particular to look at this one, the window pane you mentioned, which is in a beautiful gold church in the village of Stoke Poges in England, and it's an image whose provenance is still disputed, but it is definitely not an image of a bicycle. And yet there's been this kind of almost spiritual aura that has surrounded this thing, in part because it sits in a church, and there still are pilgrims who go to Stoke Poges to, you know, drink in the so-called bicycle window, and I think some of them may believe that they're communing with the bicycle when they look at that thing.
So to talk about the true origin story, there's this sort of interesting theory that you outline. It's not your theory, but it's one that, you know, is even promoted on coinage, German coinage. This idea that the bicycle was invented because of a volcanic explosion. So what's the story there, and what's the origin story, the actual invention, and who is this, you know, this very interesting, almost absurd figure who invented the bicycle?
Right. So the inventor of the bicycle is a guy named Carl von Dreis, who was a minor German nobleman. He was living in Mannheim at the time of this invention. He was technically a forester. This was the chief forester of the Duchy of Baden, but in practice, he didn't really do much foresting. He kind of had that appointment, drew a salary, but spent his time kind of daydreaming and tinkering. And he actually invented a lot of cool little gizmos, a kind of prototypewriter, various dictation devices, other cool gadgets. But he was particularly interested in the question of horseless travel, because because of course at this time the only way to move swiftly over land was by hitching up some kind of draft animal to some sort of cart, you know, horse or donkey or dog or whatever, to drag you across land. And so in 1817, after various attempts, he makes this kind of eureka breakthrough where he, instead of putting two wheels on either side of some sort of carriage or cart or device, he lines them up in a row and realizes that by stretching there, kind of like connecting them with a piece of wood and then straddling that device as you would a horse, you can stay balanced and move the thing forward. The device he created was, he called a Laufmaschine, or a running machine. That's because it was a thing that you literally kind of, as I say, straddled and ran while straddling, ran across the ground while straddling. You rode it by centering your body weight in it and kind of scooting or skating your feet across the ground, much like the little wooden balance bikes that children use today to learn to ride. Those are very much just modern Laufmaschines. As for how the circumstances under which, you know, the circumstances that led to this eureka moment, this breakthrough for him, that is unknown and a subject of some dispute in bicycle historiography. The story that you're referring to, and one that is just a theory but widely accepted, is the idea that, pardon me, that at the time of its invention in 1816, there was this ecological, this environmental catastrophe. There was an explosion, to make a long story short, a giant eruption of a volcano on an island in Indonesia, which shot so much dust, so much dust into the atmosphere that it dimmed the sun and led to all kinds of bad climactic consequences for much of the world in the West. This is the famous year without a summer of 1816, when there was snow in the winter in North America. Snow in the summer in North America, very cold temperatures, crops died, horses dropped dead. There were shortages of feed for the horses. And it was because of this that the theory goes that Carl von Dreis, his thoughts, he was sitting there in Bavaria. The temperatures were cold in the summer. There weren't enough oats to feed the horses. And suddenly he was like, we got to come up with some horse alternative here. And so his thoughts, the story goes, turned once again to the question of horseless transport, and he came up with this Laufmaschine, or running machine. You know, I am a little skeptical that is the true story. It's a theory that was espoused by a great scholar named Hans Erhard Lessing, but he himself admits that it's just a theory. The only thing that Carl von Dreis said himself in his own writings about this invention was that he was inspired by ice skating. So that again points to an origin in the wintertime, and also makes sense given that you kind of impel this thing by skating your feet across the ground.
So just, you know, even a couple years later, you know, the Laufmaschine, or the velocipede, many different names for it, had already made its way to England. And you have this, you know, really great little tale of the, you know, these lords and barons, you know, participating in a dandy horse race. And if you could talk a little about, you know, the kind of initial reception of the bicycle and its impact on culture.
Yeah. So, well, Dreis was a kind of promoter, a sort of huckster in his way, of his invention. He took out patents in various places and wanted to. He was kind of an evangelist for his machine. So he went to France, and various manufacturers started producing these things in France. There was a little vogue for them in Paris, especially. There were they were pretty pricey machines. It cost a lot of money to produce one of these things. And so it was not a democratic machine. We think of the bicycle as something that is for the masses, but that's really a phenomenon of the 1890s bicycle boom. At this point, they're expensive. So it was well-to-do people who could afford them. Anyway, soon after they arrived in France, they made their way to England, where again, various manufacturers began to build these things. And a fad for them kind of erupted briefly, but intensely, especially around the year 1819, among the kind of, beau monde of London at that time. Famously, what was called in England, the velocipede, or nicknamed the dandy charger, the dandy horse, the dandy cart, was embraced by the Prince Regent himself. This was the period of the Regency. So George, the kind of ne'er-do-well son of the king, who was such a famous party boy, had his great big palace in Brighton, where all the CNBC crowd went to debauch. he had five of these things that he kept at his palace in Brighton, and a number of the people in that kind of set embraced the thing. So there was this vogue for them, especially among so-called dandies, that is, you know, well-dressed, well-bred, rich party boys, young men in London in this sort of period of the height of the Regency. It's interesting because, you know, as I say, we think of the bicycle as something that is a machine for the masses, but at this point it was very much, you know, a plaything of the wealthy, and for that reason became the object of populist resentment. So there was a sort of an instant backlash among regular people towards this machine, in part because it was associated with these rich wastrels, but also because it was thought to be a kind of illicit or illegitimate machine. It was taking up space on roads that were thought to be the exclusive domain of horses and horse-drawn vehicles. And also these things were run a lot on pavements, sidewalks, and in the parks of London and other cities. And because people viewed these things as illicit and dangerous, as a threat to, you know, they were thought to be freaking out horses. There's some evidence that this was true. Horses would start at the sight of one of these things, and also, posed a danger to pedestrians. Various bans were enacted, both in England, first in England, and then in various other places that this machine reached. Interestingly, there's evidence that a number of these things made their way to Calcutta, and that a similar ban was imposed there. And there also were velocipedes like this in the States a couple years later, 1820, 1821, and the same pattern repeated. So, you know, there were swiftly bans were imposed by authorities who thought, yeah, these things need to be pushed off the road. So that very first kind of bicycle boom or bicycle boomlet was A, quite short-lived, and B, very much, anticipated some of the same debates that we see to this day about whether the bicycle is a legitimate vehicle, whether a cyclist has a right to the roadway, that sort of one.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Get 20% off your first order at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. Save 20% at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
Yeah, you have this kind of funny quote from the poet John Keats reacting to the bicycle, and he is not a fan of it, which was, you know, funny to think of him being there, you know, sort of observing the invention and then first rise of the bicycle. You mentioned a little bit this idea of the bicycle sort of taking over the road and imposing on, you know, the domain of horses. Can you talk a little bit, you know, just about this general rivalry between horses and bikes, and, you know, what they're kind of different symbol, you know, the different cultural symbols, you know, the horse being maybe more traditional, the bike being this kind of thing that was more revolutionary, a feminist form of transportation as well.
Yeah. So right from the start, the bicycle was framed as a kind of replacement horse. To go back to Carl von Dreis, he said this explicitly. He made a comparison between the horse and the bicycle in terms of, like, how quickly they could move. His very first ride, I think, pointedly, this was a sort of public demonstration in Mannheim where he unveiled the Laufmaschine. He went to a stables, that ride ended at a stables. And I think he was making a kind of rhetorical point there. This is the new horse. Right from the get-go, it was perceived as a threat by people who, for instance, made their livelihoods in the horse trade in various ways. So hackney carriage drivers, veterinarians, blacksmiths who created horseshoes. All these people looked upon the bicycle as both, you know, a very poor replacement for the horse, a very weird idea that you want to have a machine instead of a horse, but also a threat in economic terms. And this we can sort of trace this theme forward through the various stages of the bicycle's development. So in, you know, the middle part of the 19th century, you get a new bicycle that was known as a bone shaker because it had sort of big wheels, but it was, again, poorly engineered. This, unlike the Laufmaschine, was a bike driven by pedals, but it was a direct drive. The pedals were on the wheel as opposed to, you know, they weren't in the middle of the bike pulling a rear driven chain. And then comes the famous high wheeler or penny farthing. That's that crazy looking bike with the giant front wheel and the very small one in the back, again with a direct drive. But in this period too, the rhetoric around the bicycle was like, yeah, this is the new horse. And moreover, it's better than the horse, because unlike the horse, it's cheaper. You don't have to keep it in a stable. You don't have to feed it. It's not going to get sick, at least not in the same way a horse does. It doesn't foul the pavement by going to the bathroom, all that sort of stuff. Columbia Bicycle is one of the big early American bicycle manufacturers, called their their advertising literature, they called them big advertising posters. They called their high wheeler bicycle an ever saddled horse, which eats nothing. This tension existed, and by the time we get what is known as the safety bicycle, the modern bicycle with the rear chain drive, the diamond shaped frame, this bicycle, it was called the safety bicycle because it was safer than the earlier models. It was, you know, you were less prone to, as they used to say, taking the header, flying over the handlebars and pitching off and clunking your head on the pavement. And by the time we get that bike in 1885, this horse bicycle rivalry is something that's been, you know, is now decades old. But in this period, the bicycles, you know, that up until that time, there were a lot of utopian dreams around the bicycle before the 1885. But once we get that safety bicycle with pneumatic tires and a much better engineered bike, a much cheaper bike that many more people, millions more people can suddenly ride, we have suddenly the people's nag, the people's horse, a machine for the masses. And it is truly a revolutionary moment. This, the long dreamed of successor to the horse-drawn cart has arrived. It's viewed as a machine which is an emancipatory device, providing not just a new kind of personal autonomy, but supercharging your ability to move quickly across the land, but also has all kinds of political resonances. Famously, this bike was the new bike was one that women could ride, or it was thought with the earlier, more poorly engineered bikes that it was too dangerous for women to ride them. Suddenly, you have millions of women taking to them, and they become, along with the bloomer pantaloons that women take to wearing in order to ride these, truly a symbol of, you know, emancipated new womanhood, both a symbol and a kind of tool of resistance for suffragists who ride these things to the barricades. So yeah, there's all that kind of new political symbolism and around the bicycle, and the horse then is embraced by kind of bicycle opponents with a very pointed political animus. It's people who align themselves against the new woman, the kind of suffragist cause, embrace the bicycle on sort of traditionalist terms. The bicycle was, since it was a machine for the masses, there were horse partisans who clung to the horse as a kind of icon of the old, better social order, of agrarianism over against modernity and the machine age, etc.
you sort of, you know, started talking about the kind of the role that, you know, the bike has played for, you know, maybe let's say political dissidents or, you know, activists. What is it about the bicycle that has allowed it to, you know, be this sort of tool for those without much power to kind of assert themselves? You know, you even talk about the, you know, the use of the bike as a, you know, as in protest, the use of the bike for war. You know, it's something that you can hop on, you can ride in really quickly and do something, and then you can, you know, hightail it out of there really, you know, without making any sound. What are sort of the ways in which the bike has been used in these ways?
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. The bicycle is cheap, first and foremost, you know, compared to certain other, you know, other forms of transportation. So it's available to many people. And if, you know, you can organize a bicycle protest pretty quickly. You can, as you mentioned, you can kind of mobilize but also elude authorities on bikes. So it has been, it's definitely played a role in all kinds of social movements. There's been, you know, of course and today with the environment, you know, beginning in the 70s with the rise of the environmental movement, the bicycle was, you know, very importantly seen as an alternative to the car. The name of my book is Two Wheels Good. That comes from a bicycle activist phrase, which is of course derived from a phrase in George Orwell's Animal Farm. But the idea there is two wheels good, four wheels bad. The bike has very much been championed as this greener, cleaner machine, a machine that can even, you know, save the world, that will lead to better personal health outcomes, but also, you know, a healthier planet. So there's a lot of this kind of rhetoric around the bicycle for good reason. You know, obviously, like cities in our current age would be healthier, cleaner, serener, more habitable if we were all riding around on bikes as opposed to, you know, stuck in horrible traffic jams in automobiles. But one of the things that I point out in the bike is that in the book about the bike is that bicycles are you know, they don't have any kind of fixed meaning. Their political valence depends on the time and place and where you are. So you know, and this is where, you know, I departed from a lot of the trade book literature on the bike, which has you know, viewed the bike as purely this emancipatory device, this insurgent, even punk vehicle, because bicycles were used, for instance, by colonial officials in you know, colonies in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. A lot of the places that the bicycle first reached, they were ridden by soldiers or missionaries or prospectors who were, you know, riding the bicycle onto indigenous lands or to wage war. So this is an interesting aspect of bicycle culture, which is coming into focus a lot more these days, because for instance, in cities today, you have on the one hand these wonderful bike sharing schemes and a kind of resurgent bicycle activism that's championing the idea of the bicycle as a vehicle that can improve people's lives, bring us safer streets, better cities. But others have pointed out that in fact, when you build bicycle lanes, you often bring gentrification to neighborhoods, that there's inequities that arrive with the bicycle. We see this also in terms of the manufacturing of the bicycle, because even though the bicycle's reputation is that of a clean green machine, the bicycle is a product of capitalism. There are raw materials that have to be pulled out of the ground in order to create a bicycle. Extractive industries have problematic human rights records. There's incidents in places like Bangladesh and Vietnam where you have child laborers building bicycles. So the bicycle as a kind of political tool is kind of perennially up for grabs. I'll say one more thing about this. This is very dramatically illustrated here in New York City in the summer of 2020, when, you know, in the wake of the murder of George Floyd, there was the great uprising with thousands and thousands pouring into the streets to protest. Many here in New York, many of those people were riding bicycles, but they were met out in the streets by New York's own brigade of bicycle, of armored bicycle cops, who not only used their bicycles as kind of shields, but as bludgeons, as weapons in these protests. So you had a fight for the political meaning of the bicycle happening right out there on the streets in 2020.
Something that you include in the book is this, a really interesting section of just your personal history with the bike. And I think it helps, make sense of, the sort of approach and tack that you've taken to writing this book, because I think that, this is a very, I think, different book than other nonfiction books that I've read. Each chapter really is, kind of takes a different approach and different focus. So, how did you first, what's your earliest memories with biking, and, what is your current, relationship with biking like?
Yeah. The funny thing about that chapter is I was a little nervous about doing memoir in any way. It's not my super duper comfort zone. Although there, I do write in the first person quite a bit in this book. But what I realized was this is a kind of how the sausage is made aspect of this. But there were various themes that I wasn't able to get into the book that I wanted to write about. So writing a memoir chapter was kind of my sneaky way of shoehorning in ideas about what it's like to bike in the city and in New York in particular, to discuss sort of briefly the history of children and bicycles and the ideal of the child's first ride on a bike, to talk about growing old on a bike, and also to get into some of the big questions about the future of the bike in the city, safety and lack thereof for cyclists. All these things I kind of managed to kind of sneak in via this device of a memoir chapter. But in terms of, it turned out to be like the right choice, I think, because, you don't always want to be speaking as some sort of alleged expert about history. And this is the one subject to which I can make a decent claim to be expert, which is my own experiences, riding bikes around. Bikes have always been a big part of my daily routine, but also, a big part of, like, for lack of a better term, my this will sound grandiose, but my spiritual life. Like, I get to a zone of that I don't get to in other realms of life, in other, like, literal walks of life when I'm on a bike. Like, when I'm walking around town, I often feel like I'm kind of, forging a river, or like walking through the mire or quicksand or something, because I'm so used to moving swiftly on my bike. At this point in my biking life, it's almost like a physical need I have to be on the bike, because I don't feel great being off one, especially when I'm just like, you know, going about my daily business here in New York. I should add, I'm not at all a sport cyclist. I'm like a transport, not sport guy. Like, I don't really know how to ride a bike properly. I've never squeezed myself into spandex, which is definitely good for myself and for my family and the community at large. And you know, like when people have asked me, like people who are real cyclists who actually know how to ride a bike and maybe like, you know, take their bike out of New York City to like Bear Mountain in New Jersey or something like that, and you know, ride the mountain. When I've had to ride along with those people, I huff and puff and it's a disaster. So, but on a bike, you know, touring around the city, I feel pretty good. And I wanted to like use this chapter to kind of discuss that, those kind of sensual, spiritual aspects of being a cyclist and kind of sort through my ideas about it. So yeah.
In another section in the book, you talk about a cyclist named Danny McCaskill. And you mentioned this particular video that went viral on YouTube that he put up in 2009 of him, you know, he's riding a mountain bike, sort of doing BMX type tricks, but it's just like unbelievable. And when I was reading that section, I pulled the video up and it was really strange because I remember seeing it when it came out. And what's funny about it too, is I actually like had this brief period of time in like 2009, 2010, where I was like an obsessive, like fixed geared bicyclist. I was really bad at it, but you know, but there was this kind of, I'm sure you remember like 2009, 2010, 11, this kind of like fixed gear, you know, moment. And yeah, I remember watching that video and I was like, I need to get into biking again. That's a really great video. And yeah, something about it too is the song in it is Funeral by Band of Horses, which I thought was kind of funny that it's that Band of Horses and it's the bicycle and it kind of like frames it. So
yeah, it's funny. That section of the book it focuses, it's sort of like a mini profile of this great, what's called a trial cyclist, Danny McCaskill. This is, you know, his cycling art is doing these trial cycling is a sport which privileges balance above all. It's about trying to like ride around without ever letting your feet hit the ground and doing all kinds of, I assume I can say this on this podcast, like rad badass stunts, like, you know, like jumping your bike off of from great heights, you know, hopping between bollards, you know, kind of shredding the cityscape in something like what a practitioner of parkour does or a skater. So I used the story of Danny McCaskill to kind of like then dip back into the 19th century history of trick cycling. But what I think is, you know, one of the most interesting aspects of that chapter and really, you know, one of the key themes in the story of the bicycle generally is this idea that a bicycle is not just a device that you can roll along the ground. It's a kind of a flying machine. A lot of what Danny McCaskill does and what trick cyclists have done through the decades and across and now over two centuries is get air, you know what I mean? Like fly through the air on the bike. This is an idea that, you know, was in bicycle culture right from the beginning, to go back to that Lauf machine or the velocipede. The early observers of that thing compared it to Pegasus, you know, the winged stallion of Greek mythology. And we can trace this idea straight up through bicycle culture to the present day. So there were always these ideas about the bicycle as as a flying machine. Before there was ever an airplane, people were kind of trying to create bicycle airships, various hybrids where you, you know, attach wings to a bike. There's famous advertising images from the period of the great 1890s bicycle boom, which depict kind of nymphs or, you know, goddesses, mythological figures, women generally on bicycles in outer space. And of course, we can trace this right up to the present day, or to more recent times, something like E.T., the famous bike ride in E.T. where the child and the alien go, are silhouetted against the moon and go biking through the night sky. And this for me is like the romantic image idea of the bike that I can really get the time behind, because of course when you're on the bike, you sometimes really do feel like you're flying. You're not quite earthbound, at least in your mind. And also, if you want to get technical about it, you are traveling on air, because there's pneumatic tires that are kind of holding you aloft from the pavement. So yeah. In a way, to go back to trick cycling, you know, anytime you get on a bike, you're performing a stunt, right? You're keeping the bike balanced. You're riding the bike on air. You're making, you know, all these little corrections basically the entire time that you're not even conscious of to keep the bike upright. In a sense, we're all trick cyclists, and in a sense, we're all cyclists are pilots as well as you know, travelers on terra firma.
Well, Jody, thank you so much for being on New Books Network. It was great talking to you. I really recommend this book, even for those that aren't cyclists. If someone doesn't bike and reads this book, maybe it will inspire them to get out there and ride around. I certainly, you know, agree with you. I think biking is, you know, I try and bike every single day, and it's definitely a day without biking is not as good as a day with one with biking. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Caleb. Appreciate it.